Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. Okay, Rav, it's time for you to invite everyone to the chat room and add your glorious words of wisdom for the day.
My words of wisdom. I've got words of wisdom today. The words of wisdom is come to the chat room, eldontaylor.com/chat. Actually, you don't even have to come and chat. You can just come and observe if you like. And as I said, there are often tips and additional bits of information there that you could well find very, very helpful. So that is eldontaylor.com/chat.
All right. Now, every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our show was all about what happens to you when you die. Our guest was Annie Kagan, and she shared some of the information that her brother Billy brought to her from the other side. Julie wrote, "That was a great show." Brian wrote, "Annie sounded very sincere and not too practiced at her delivery, which is nice to hear." Elaine commented, "I have to say that what Annie says resonates. I feel like one of the biggest lessons in life I've had is to be truly at peace in each moment, not angry, not frustrated, not wanting this or that, but whole and complete each moment." David Doc from our chat room added, "This show was amazing, brought us all to a new level of understanding." Scarlett wrote, "Love your mind and program on Hay House." Well, thank you, Scarlett. Sharon wrote, "I am a member of Coast to Coast, and I love the May 7th show. Thank you very much for sharing your knowledge, understanding, and insight on how the brain works. I have been feeling stuck and alone for a long time, but with your help, I believe I am on the right path to grow again. Thank you, and may God bless you and yours." Well, thank you, Sharon, for your feedback and sincere blessings. They are both much appreciated. Now, for all of you, that Coast to Coast show is up on YouTube if you don't happen to be a member. I think one of the better shows that I've ever done. So check it out. What did you think of that show, Raph?
It was a fabulous show. But your shows always are. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Enough. Grant wrote, "I am just finishing your book, I believe, and what a joy it is." Well, thank you, Grant. David wrote, "For a modern day genius, you are a cool guy. Thank you for all your help." Well, I'm flattered by that, David, and you are most welcome. Jane wrote, "Thank you for the free InterTalk programs you offer. I used loss of a loved one after my father died, and it helped me enormously." Now, both David and Jane are speaking about our free InterTalk MP3 programs that we make available as a part of our own Pay It Forward efforts. You can get yours by simply going to InterTalk, InterTalk.com, and choosing free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. The programs are not samples. They are the real deal, the patented and scientifically proven effective InterTalk technology. So go get yours. What's stopping you? Pamela wrote, "Thank you for all the special work you do for the universe. Giving is receiving blessings." Amen, Pamela. How very true. David wrote, "I just finished a 20-minute stress relief hypnosis session that is free on your website. Thanks, I feel amazing. I find that my subconscious mind certainly likes to laugh because I came out of the session with pure joy. I want to learn how to share this with others." Well, David, you and everyone else can now learn to do this on your own anytime and anywhere you would like and without spending a fortune to do so. Indeed, in my book, Self-Hypnosis and Subliminal Technology, you'll not only learn that, it comes with a CD and URLs for more online training, but it teaches you how to master both of these technologies, and the book is available for under $15. Believe me, this is an unbelievable price. People literally pay thousands of dollars to learn one of these technologies. There's nothing else to buy. This is a complete course. So if you're interested in more command of your mind, this is indeed one pathway worth investigating. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to Eldon at eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, True Refuge with Tara Brach. I must begin by sharing a personal experience. I found today's guest quite by accident. That is, if you think there really is any such thing. On YouTube, and I don't even remember what I was searching for. But her style, manner, and delivery, combined with her message, literally seemed to somehow enchant and captivate me. I found myself listening at a time when I was pressed to do many other things. So when the urgency of the moment arose, I simply paused the presentation and returned when I could. That meant for days this YouTube page remained open on my browser so that little by little I could take advantage of her message. Okay, by now, you also are all probably aware that whenever we have a guest, I take a look at the information they are likely to spiel and what skeptics may have to say about them and their message. Often I will bring credible information to the forefront by way of a question. Questions that I give the guest, and therefore they have the opportunity to defend themselves or set the record straight at that time. Now, that said, I do love it when our guests bring such solid insight that we can focus on their message without distraction. Today's guest puts an emphasis on the power of meditation, and this is what a typical skeptic has to say about that. Quote, meditation is a practice that has been scientifically demonstrated effective at promoting enhanced psychological well-being, focus, self-awareness, present moment orientation, and as a means of treatment for depression and anxiety. Excuse me, close quote. In her book, True Refuge, Finding Peace and Freedom in Your Own Awakened Heart, Tara Brach states, quote, my prayer is that we trust the beauty of our hearts and awareness. Holding hands, may we help to bring healing and freedom to our world. May all beings realize their essence as loving awareness. May all beings live their lives from this awakened heart. May all beings be happy. May all beings touch great natural peace. May there be peace on earth, peace everywhere. May all beings awaken and be free. Close quote. Now that's quite a prayer, and it's indeed a tall order. Do you think it's even reasonably possible? Well, according to Congressman Tim Ryan, who has discussed mindfulness right here on Provocative Enlightenment with us, Tara's book, and I quote, inspires the confidence needed to face our deepest, most difficult emotions. This book can initiate a transformation that will allow a kinder, compassionate, and more mindful nation to emerge. Close quote. So who is this woman? Tara Brach is a leading Western teacher of Buddhist meditation, emotional healing, and spiritual awakening. She has practiced and taught meditation for over 35 years with an emphasis on mindfulness meditation. She teaches that beneath the turbulence of our thoughts and emotions exists a profound stillness, a silent awareness capable of limitless love. Dr. Tara Brach is a clinical psychologist. Her dissertation explored meditation as a therapeutic modality. She lived for several years in an ashram, and she trained with Joseph Goldstein. She describes this experience as, quote, I found wisdom teachings and practices that train the heart and mind in unconditional, lucid, loving presence, in being with life as it is. Close quote. Dr. Brach is the founder of the Insight Meditation Community and the Meditation Teacher Training Institute of Washington, D.C., and the best-selling author of the award-winning book, Radical Acceptance. So let's get her in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. Tara Brach.
Well, thank you, Eldon. I'm so happy we have this accidental connection here.
So I am it. I, and, yeah. And I was charmed. That is a very true story. So to begin with, though, please tell us about your personal journey. What was the path that life had for you, leading you to where you are today?
Oh, my, that's one of the big ones, isn't it? Well, I think if I had to say some highlights, Eldon, it would be that when I was younger, I had a very charmed upbringing in many ways, but I landed, as so many people, with that sense of not enough, not good enough, you know, something's wrong with me, need to be better. And when I got attracted to spiritual practices, I first got attracted to a yoga ashram, I actually brought all those same struggles right in. I became kind of a type A yogi.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went right into the ashram and began striving and vigorously trying to get enlightened. Over those 6 years, I remember I had this question of what else can I do? And every time I'd go to a spiritual teacher, the response would be, just relax. And then I would take that on as my next project. So it really was, I'd say, when I discovered Buddhist meditation that I actually took that invitation more seriously, that meditation is really a homecoming, that we're relaxing back into who we already are. We're not trying to perfect something or be different. And so for these last number of decades, I've been drawing on Buddhist psychology and Buddhist meditation to really inform us on how we can begin to relax and trust and inhabit the truth and the goodness of who we are.
Okay, you know, to sort of set the stage and by way of background for our audience, at the heart of much of your teaching is, as you point out, the Buddha's insight that all is suffering. The First Noble Truth speaks to this, and the second insists that suffering is caused by attraction and aversion. The Third Noble Truth offers a way out of suffering via the elimination of ignorance, reducing attraction and aversion. And, of course, the fourth is the prescription known as the Eightfold Path, the principal areas of which address things like action, speech, and thought, thus right action, right speech, and mindfulness by way of example. Now, the Mahayana tradition teaches that all of us, and that includes the things around us, have no independent existence. To understand things as they are, we need to understand them as empty. Your approach often reminds me of this teaching. So what I'm going to ask you to do is flesh it out for us and explain how it holds a remedy for suffering.
Well, and if I was going to simplify a little, because sometimes I think the language gets in the way, we might understand suffering as forgetting who we really are. That the Buddha taught that the basic ignorance is ignoring the awareness and the love that's here, and instead getting caught in some idea that you're Eldon, a separate self who has these pluses and these minuses, and I'm Tara with these strengths and these weaknesses, and forgetting, kind of like the waves forgetting their oceanness. And so in what you call the Mahayana and emptiness, what the teaching really is that we have these different wave-like qualities, and we have our personalities, and we have our bodies, and we have our thoughts, and so on. But if our whole identity is organized around that sense of a separate self, and we forget this essence awareness that's here, like that in you which is really listening, that tenderness of the heart, if we forget that presence, then we get caught up in suffering, because inevitably, these separate selves are going to get sick, die, lose everything we love. So the big inquiry in Buddhism, and I think this is for all the spiritual paths, are how can we remember the wholeness, the truth of who we are, and that way really celebrate these changing lives, but not get caught in defending ourselves so much, or get caught in that sense that around the corner something's terrible is going to happen, so I have to tense and protect myself against that. How to really live the moment fully?
You know, I love the philosophy from a philosophical standpoint. On a day-to-day basis, I think the difficulty most people have is in dealing with the issues of a moment, you know, and you have dealt with a lot of those, and we're going to discuss some of them straight out of your book. But you know, I'm reminded that when you have a bursting appendix, it's rather difficult to think of yourself as not being the body that is receiving that immediate pain. You, of course, have done this now for, 35 plus years. What's the magic bullet to transcending that immediate need, stepping aside from it and seeing ourselves as participating in it and independent of it at the same moment?
Don't begin practice in the midst of an acute appendicitis. begin in the, there's many, many moments of our lives when things are not in crisis, and we can just dedicate a short period of time each day to begin to train our mind so that we are able to step out of all the thoughts, because, we're lost in a trance of thinking. If you review the day, for most of us, we've been in a virtual reality. So just a little training to come out of that virtual reality and just connect with this moment and then this moment and a kind of pause. We find that there's something that shines through in the spaces that begins to feel more and more familiar as a quality of presence and openness. Now, it'll collapse. When we're in the midst of crisis, we're going to get small and struggle for our survival. That's okay. We have a survival brain. In fact, if we didn't, get alarmed when we felt pain, or if we didn't, pursue our sensual desires, we wouldn't be here. But the point is, there's more than that that's possible. And I really like thinking of it, Eldon, in a kind of evolutionary way, the evolution of consciousness, that, we have this survival brain, and of course we're going to be still operating off the conditioning that helps us, make it through the day. But we also have, the most recently evolved part of our brain, the frontal cortex, this capacity for compassion, for empathy, to perceive a larger sense of connectedness. And we have a capacity for mindfulness, which means that we notice what's going on without being identified with it. So I look at it as a both and, that we completely accept and allow that we have our survival strategies, and we cultivate this larger knowing, because the more moments that we tap into that, the more when the going gets tough, we have some remembrance that helps create some space and ease in the midst of difficulty.
Of course, the third form of suffering, according to the Buddha, is something we think of as pervasive conditioning. And I think that, the best analogy I've ever heard for that, a professor once said to me, imagine that you go to your travel agent, and your travel agent says, I have the perfect destination for you for this vacation. And you're just going to love it. There are wonderful beaches. The sun shines. It's a fantastic, absolutely fantastic place. And it's very affordable. Now, you should know that, some people don't come back. There are lightning storms and people get struck by that. And there are some rare insects that have deadly poisons, and some people die of that. There have been accidents that have been known caused because of, and on and on and on. And his point was this: if you had this travel agent give you this insight about your destination, you'd probably look at that travel agent and think they were crazy. And yet at the same time, that's exactly what we have in life, that same uncertainty every day, every moment. And part of what you do assuages that anxiety that attends our daily pressures, albeit often unconsciously. Do you want to address that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I love your story. I think it's a great metaphor, because the truth is, it is entirely uncertain, and the ground will get pulled from underneath us. That's true. So how do we live with uncertainty and not be so busy steeling ourselves against what's going to come that we can't love each other and be creative and enjoy the moments? And I think of William James, who said, that the beginning of all religions is the cry help, that we are in tune with our existential predicament, that, it's hairy. So right. How we respond to that, there's something fundamental in us that's figuring out, how do I get through the day? And how we respond to that question makes a difference between a life that's lived fully and a life that's very, very confined and controlled. And I often track my own inner controller, and you know, with as much forgiveness and humor as I can, because there's a part of us that's trying to make sure it all works out according to our plans. But the good news on the spiritual path is that there are practices that can help us discover a sense of balance and ease amidst the uncertainty, so that we actually can draw on our best resources. And I often talk of true refuge versus false refuge, that a true refuge is when we come into the moment, or we remember what we love, when we rest in something larger, when we sense right now as we're on this show beyond our roles that there's this awareness and this the intention of waking up and healing. When we tap into that kind of thing, that's true refuge. But we all have a lot of false refuges that we still play out, where we need to self-aggrandize, you know, like prove ourselves or inflate ourselves, or where we judge or put down, or we get addicted to substances. We have ways of trying to avoid being with this life. So I look at the spiritual path a lot about bringing a real honesty to, okay, so where am I kind of running away? You know, I think of it as like we're bicycling away from the present moment, and the more we get stressed, the more that help is kind of frantic, the faster we pedal. And right. How can we start noticing that and maybe not pedal so fast, and maybe bring some interest and compassion to what's happening here? Because it's really only when we pause that we can tap into the resources of true refuge. It's only when we pause. And I'll just add one thing, which is...
Please.
Viktor Frankl has a wonderful line that says, between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space is our power and our freedom. And I think of so much of the healing and meditative practices that I know you are really behind, and I am... really have to do with slowing down and pausing so we can come back into our life. And it's kind of the way one palliative caregiver who had been with thousands of people as they were dying said that the biggest regret of the dying is really not living true to ourselves, that we lived according to the expectations of others and the shoulds and the internalized messages. And we really lived on our false refuges, the strategies that we were trying to control things with. And so I don't think of that as just as the dying. I mean, I feel like you and I and all that are listening right now, we each have something in us monitoring and saying, well, am I living true to myself? Am I really living from a quality of heart and presence versus that kind of reactive controlling? And really the path is just continuing to align ourselves with what matters, coming home to ourselves.
And, you know, when you speak about dying, and we have had several hospice personnel, the hospice doctors, nurses, et cetera, on this show. I mean, what you addressed is absolutely correct, but we often hear it through the lens of compensatory mechanisms, the anger or the aggression that was expressed because of these feelings of fear or insecurity and how that hostility seems to poison the passing moment, leaves people with great regret. So, I mean, obviously you're preaching to the choir. I am 100% behind what it is that you are saying. We have a hard break coming up on us, but when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you something based on the setup piece. And that's just, do you think meditation is essential, or is it just another good idea? So I'll let you play with that one for a minute. We're speaking with Dr. Tara Brock about her book, True Refuge. If you're not already in our chat room, now is a great time to join in the conversation. We have a short movie for you today of her. And, you know, if you wanted to see what enhanced me, this is just a tease. So be sure to log into eldontaylor.com/chat. That's eldontaylor.com/chat. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Tara. I will say it without my West Coast Tara accent. Dr. Tara Brock, about her book, True Refuge. It's a great read, a great book. You're going to want to look at this one. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook as a friend or a fan. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies, and from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and get your free MP3s. All right, let's get back to the program. Dr. Brock, I suggested I was going to ask you about meditation. Now, let me frame that a bit, because around here, we talk a lot about belief and the power of belief and how it affects every aspect of our lives. And, you know, I'm regularly telling people or pointing out to them that, you know, just 30 minutes of daily meditation for 60 days will fundamentally change the physical nature of their brain. They'll actually increase the gray matter. But when I read your book and I listen to you, I guess I kind of get to this point. Do you think meditation is absolutely essential, or just another good thing we might consider undertaking if we wish to really, you know, find ourselves or find peace?
Well, I love the question, because it brings me back to a sense of our evolutionary development, which is kind of like saying at certain phases of evolution, is thinking absolutely essential? Meditation is actually a way of paying attention that already is part of our natural capacities. Mindfulness is part of what the mind does. The mind has the capacity to go kind of meta to what's going on and be aware of a process. So really the inquiry is, how much do we cultivate that? And it seems that we're at this stage in evolution where, just like people know that physical exercise is necessary if we want to be fully healthy, I think that same, there's a kind of hundredth monkey where we're getting that mental exercise, training the heart and mind, is necessary if we want to maximize our potential. And it's a basic, it's built-in capacity that we can cultivate. And so I get really amazed at watching, as you described, all the science that comes out saying, yeah, you do this, and here's what changes in the structure and the function of the brain occur. I mean, over 10,000 studies in the last decade. It rewires our brain. So my sense is that the more we wake up, the more we naturally choose to facilitate that waking up.
Okay, I guess, you know, when you're raising a family, you talk to them about three meals a day, you know, getting started with a good breakfast. Maybe you talk to them about vitamins. You definitely talk to them about exercise, the value of exercise. And where I'm going is, you know, I think one of the things that gets overlooked is, well, let me digress a bit. I can remember when I first started meditating many, many years ago, I was still carrying a gun, practicing criminalistics, running lie detection exams and so forth. And a chief of police called my home one day, meet for coffee, and my housekeeper answered the phone. And she said, "I'm sorry, I can't disturb him. He's meditating." And I took the rusing that you wouldn't believe from everybody for months after that. I think there's still a leftover kind of feeling that meditation is, you know, that's Eastern. It's attached to religion. It doesn't have a value independent of spirituality. And where I'm kind of going is, I think that the evidence And the information today shows us that we should be teaching our families, our children, ourselves about meditation in the same way that we would teach them the value of exercise or the value of eating the right foods. And that's my question to you.
We agree. And I think that when you say there's people that think of it as Eastern or exotic, it's just because it doesn't happen all at once. Our culture's waking up to it, but it's not all there. It's amazing what's happening in a lot of the institutions of the culture. I just think of Washington alone. We're teaching in a handful of prisons here. We're working on curriculum in the public schools and private schools to incorporate mindfulness. I'm working with Tim Ryan, Congressman Tim Ryan, creating a Mindful Vets project. I've taught on Capitol Hill several times to legislators and staff. I mean, it's in the culture. And so as you say, the more we wake up, the more we know, yes, of course we want our children and loved ones and everybody else to have this capacity to be awake in the moment and have more access to joy, to gratitude, to all the things that we cherish.
Amen. Now, we talk a lot about beliefs around here, as I've said earlier. And something that I notice that you do and that I really like is you believe that we should create a belief inventory. I'd like you to flesh that out, unpack the idea, and explain why we would do that and how we would benefit if we become aware of it.
We're often not aware of how much our thoughts and beliefs are creating our moods, which then drive our actions, which then create patterns that actually create our destiny. That's something I know you know about and many listeners, but day to day, we're not so aware of the core beliefs that are in there and unchallenged and really not in our consciousness that are keeping our life small. So the activity of being able to look for them, name them, write them down, helps bring more mindfulness to them. And what I've discovered when I work with people is that if we can really shine the light of awareness on our beliefs, we can start getting that they're real, real by meaning they're running through our nervous system and creating an effect, but they're not true. They're not truth. And when we can begin to sense, you know, I'm having a thought, but the thought's not, it's just, you know, a soundbite. It's just an image. It's not reality. You know, it's a representation. When we can say, oh, this is a belief. It's been deeply conditioned, but it doesn't mean it's true. There is a little bit of space to begin to discover something that really can begin to give us freedom. So I feel like that's very much a part of the training, and the belief inventory helps to kind of create a wedge where we get more conscious of what might be driving us.
Rich, you give some wonderful examples in your book of you know, belief inventories. I need to work hard for approval or love. I am not worthy of being loved. I don't deserve to be happy. Anyone I get close to will hurt me. I will hurt anyone I love. I need to protect myself or I will get hurt. And on and on and on. And these are the kinds of, I think of them as self-talk reflections that we often get back when we try to say something affirmative to ourselves. When we say, I am good, maybe we get that line that comes back that says, sure, good at what? And so what you're encouraging, if I understand you, is take the time to record these thoughts, to create this inventory so that you can develop a method by which you become fully aware of them. Because I think you think that, and let me, I'm just going to quote you here. The more you are mindful of your beliefs, the less force they will exert on your psyche. You think that's true?
Absolutely. It's being mindful of them and discovering something that is larger than them. So one step is that we notice, oh, okay, I use the language of the trance of unworthiness, that we have, most of us have some constellation of beliefs that say, I'm not enough, I'm falling short, I'm deficient, I'm not good enough as a partner, I need to get better, you know, we have that going, and it's I call it a trance, Eldon, because most people would say, yeah, I judge myself too much, but we're not aware of the pervasive effect that it has. If we're feeling in some way unworthy, how difficult it is to really be intimate with somebody else, because because we have the sense, oh, they'll find out. You know, or if we feel unworthy, how hard it is to give ourselves wholeheartedly to work because we're so afraid of failure, we're being overly careful, and we're not spontaneous or creative. So beginning to be able to name the beliefs is one step, but the next step is to start getting the knack of coming into the aliveness of the present moment, coming into a place of self-compassion, coming into a place of awakeness, so that we start sensing who we are beyond the beliefs. And the more moments that we can move from the idea of I'm falling short to perhaps feeling in our body the fear and then holding that with some compassion and then saying, oh, well, who I am is really this compassion and this presence, that's what undoes them. There's a great story of a Swami Satchidananda, a Hindu yogi who he had one of the students asked him, do I have to be a Hindu to do this yoga? And he said, oh, I am not a Hindu, I am an undo. And in a way, that's my sense of the path we're on, that we have all these beliefs and stories we've identified with, and we're gradually undoing the identification so that purity and light and goodness can shine through. And we do it bit by bit. And the belief inventory is just one strategy to begin to undo that kind of solid and deficient sense of self.
All right. Well, while we're there, I'm going to ask you then to tell us about RAIN, what it is and how does it work?
When we are stuck, when we're in reactivity, somebody criticizes us and right away rise up and need to defend, or in some way we're about to approach a frightening kind of a presentation and we're caught up in our fear about failure, those are the times we are least able to say, okay, pause, meditate, come back home to yourself. It's like on some level, our sickness is homesickness. We leave home when we're reactive. But when we've left home, the last thing in the world we can remember is how to come back. So RAIN is an acronym that really has to do with bringing a mindful presence to what's going on so we can come back home. Come back home to a wholeness of being, not be caught in a fragment of a reactive fragment. And what it stands for, each of the letters stands for an element of this mindful presence. And R means recognize. So like the belief inventory, you recognize what's going on. Let's say somebody, you get an email and there's some sort of a veiled critique. Okay, recognize. Oh, criticized. Okay, feeling criticized. And the A is allow, which means rather than run away, rather than come up with a response or a reaction, rather than judge yourself or someone else for what's happening, you just create some space and allow it all to be there. That's essential. So recognize and allow what's going on is the beginning of RAIN. The I is to investigate with kindness. Now, if you try to investigate and there's just a kind of objective, you know, looking at things analytically, it won't work. Investigation, first of all, is not analytic. It's intuitive. You feel into your body what's going on. And you do it with a gentleness. Investigate with kindness. So let's say you get that criticism in an email, and you pause, you recognize, you allow it, and then you start investigating, and you feel the kind of heat and the swelling of anger, and you keep on staying present with that, and you sense underneath that, oh, hurt. You're feeling that kind of sinking feeling and that ache, and then you realize, oh, back to that personal deficiency thing. It's actually playing into how I'm feeling bad about myself. And then perhaps there's a sense of, oh, okay, kindness. And often what I'll do with RAIN is I'll put my hand on my heart and just offer that kindness by literally touching myself. Those that are listening, you can try it. If you put your hand on your heart and vary the touch so that it actually communicates tenderness. And as we do this eye of RAIN, this investigate and bring in an intimate attention, a kindness, there's a shift in a sense of who we are. And what we find is that we're no longer the the angry or hurt victim, but there's more of that presence and that kindness that's holding ourselves, and that's the N of RAIN. We're not identified. We're back to our natural wholeness again. We've come home. We can then respond from a stronger place. In fact, after we get that email with the criticism and we've done RAIN, the response we'll give will not be as defensive. It won't fuel the cycles of that distance us from others, but rather will come from a place that's a lot more intelligent and a lot more kind. So that's just an example of RAIN when something comes up in our lives, but it's an acronym for mindful presence that helps us remember how to come home.
It's a wonderful metaphor. I love the metaphor. Whenever you have RAIN in your life, you know, and I have incorporated that one myself recently at a email experience of the kind. I mean, are you reading my mind? At any rate, it works. It really works. You discuss three archetypal gateways to presence: truth, love, and awareness. How about unpacking this construct for us and explain how that can lead us to happiness?
Sure. Well, the architecture of the book True Refuge is basically saying we all know our false refuges. We all run away from ourselves in different ways. But true refuge means staying here. And there's three gateways to really coming home to that awakeness and love that's really our nature. And one of the gateways is the practice of mindful presence, where you in a very clear way notice what's going on moment to moment, these sounds, these feelings, this breath, and really anchor ourselves in the flow that's right here. And that takes us out of the thoughts that seem to keep proliferating suffering. It takes us out of the worrying and the figuring and the judging and the planning, and it brings us to that refuge of presence that really helps us reopen to who we are. That's one of the gateways. The second gateway is the gateway, and when I say the gateway of presence, I mean that's truth, the truth of the present moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The gateway of love is when we in some way remind ourselves or help reconnect with where love is. So it might be that you think of your family, or you think of your dog, or you think of, you know, the feeling of loving connection that you had when you held, you know, your an infant, a woman nursing her infant, or whatever it is that helps us remember where love is, and that reconnects us to a larger truth. And so that's the second gateway. And then the gateway of awareness arises by taking refuge in the truth of the present moment or in love. We can then sense that more formless beingness that's always in the background. But as we get more skilled in meditation, and as there's more quietness, you can begin to directly sense, oh, right now, awareness is here. You can sense the listening that's going on, and the place of silence that's listening, or the stillness that's aware of all the aliveness. So you can sense the openness that everything's happening in, and how this wakeful space that's really our formless presence. So that's the third of the gateways, the one that's a little more challenging if we're in a reactive place. So those are the three gateways. And just as way of background, just to say what got me to pay more attention to them was in my own life when I number of different times have had kind of wake-ups where it's been really, really challenging, and that word help is like, okay, so how am I not going to go to the false refuges? How am I going to stay here? And the most recent one, Eldon, was, and I wrote about in True Refuge at the very beginning and throughout in different places, was about 8 years ago when my health took a real dive.
Right.
And as anybody knows, when your health really goes down, you know, it's like the appendicitis. It's like everything in us wants to, you know, hold on to our life, and it gets scary. And for me, I have a disease, connective tissue, part of a genetic disorder. So I was having increasing accidents in all different kinds of exercising, and one by one, I couldn't run, and then I couldn't hike up hills, and then I couldn't bike, and then I couldn't swim, and I felt like my life was being taken away from me. And I remember at one point the crisis really, it felt like a real crisis when I was up on Cape Cod and two carloads of family and friends went off to the beach without me because I couldn't walk on sand at that point. And that's when I kind of, everything cracked open. That's when the ground got pulled fully and I realized, wow, I don't know if I'll ever be able to do the things I love again. And that's when the prayer really became strong, that I really wanted to find that kind of true refuge so that no matter what happened in my life, I could feel love, that I could feel a sense of meaning, that I could feel at home, even if everything got taken away. And that prayer was really, really powerful, and that's where I started exploring those three gateways, Eldon, in a way I hadn't before, with a greater depth. And I found I needed each one of them, and they're all entirely related. But I found in those moments at the Cape that if I stayed with the gateway of truth, I could feel under the grieving a sense of presence and tenderness that was really powerful. And if then I opened to the gateway of love, I could feel it really was that I was loving life, even as I was there not being able to be on the beach. And then as I sat with that, I could sense that behind that was an awareness that's timeless, that living and dying, it was big enough to hold things. So through the book, I unpack that, the different ways that we can wake up those through those gateways, no matter what's going on in our lives.
It's a marvelous book, and the story that you tell in chapter 15, A Heart That Is Ready for Anything, essentially is the conclusion to what you're just explaining. I highly recommend the book, True Refuge, by Dr. Tara Brock. We have a caller who has been very, very patient. She's been on the line since the show started, actually. Let's take that phone call, but before I get it, so I'm sure that we don't miss an opportunity, Dr. Brock, tell everybody where they can find out more about you, where they can get your book.
Sure. Best place is through my website, which is tarabrock.com, and you can get the book through there. But also to say that there are hundreds and hundreds of free talks and meditations. It's all in get them on podcasts and so on. And so that's just a way to keep in touch with those teachings and also a schedule of where I'm out and about.
Visit YouTube and search her. You'll get mesmerized like I did. Okay, we're really short on time. Let's go to Shelley out of Cincinnati, Ohio, who has been holding on for an hour. Shelley, welcome to Provocative Enlightenment. Very quickly, you have a question for Dr. Brock.
I do. First, I want to say thank you to Tara. Your teachings have been incredible, amazing, and I am so grateful. So I know we don't have time, but I was reading a teaching the other day from another Buddhist teacher that said that we need to abandon hope, because when we're in hope, that we're not fully accepting the moment. And that was such a hard concept for me to understand, because we hold hope, like a baby, it's something we hold on to for the future. So I'm wondering if we can still hold hope, but with acceptance of what is, but with also looking that things can improve and things can get better. So
very quickly, you have about 30 seconds, Dr. Brock.
Beautiful question. There's a T.S. Eliot says, I told my heart to wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. When hope is like an expectation, and when we're holding on tight, it gets us in trouble. But if it's what you described, if it's a sense of openness to possibility, it's absolutely life-saving. If we can sense what's possible and hold that in front of us as an aspiration, it's beautiful. So, yes, the kind of hope you described is an enlightened kind of hope, and go for it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the phone call, Shelley. Do check out Dr. Brock's book and check out her website. We appreciate you all. We've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I want to thank our behind-the-scenes team, Kyle and Joe, as well as the rest of the gang at Hay House Radio, for making what we do on this show so easy and pleasurable. And, of course, a great big thank you to our guest. We're going to have to bring you back again, Dr. Brock. and to all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And if you have comments on our show, do let us know. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.